hiatus of several Sunday evenings for Christmas, we return to conclude our studies in the book of Judges. I thought it good to complete this study on the last Lord's Day evening of the year. Next Lord's Day night, we will consider a subject apropos of the new year, and then begin a short series on the book of Ruth, which very clearly and explicitly belongs with Judges in the Bible. Now, you remember from the last time that the book of Judges concludes with an epilogue in two parts, just as it began with a prologue in two parts. And we took the first part of the epilogue last time. And the two parts are clearly connected to one another, as we demonstrated last time, not least by the fourfold repetition of the refrain, "In those days Israel had no king, everyone did what was right in his own eyes," or "everyone did as he saw fit." That refrain occurs twice in the first part of the epilogue and twice in the second. We have it first at 17:6, "In those days Israel had no king, everyone did as he saw fit." You have it in a shorter form in the two middle repetitions in 18:1 and 19:1, and in a complete form once again in 21:25, the last verse of the book. The two longer statements, the first instance of it and the last, therefore form an inclusio, framing the entire epilogue and telling us what to think about the events that are narrated in it. The people were leading themselves into sin. There was no positive covenantal discipline. There was instead moral anarchy. And these chapters are clearly an epilogue to the book, not a continuation of the main body, because they concern the life of the people of Israel in general and do not concern the career of any judge. In fact, no judge is mentioned at all in the final five chapters of the book. As we saw last time, the theme of this epilogue is the moral chaos that resulted from Israel's defection from the Lord and his covenant, a defection that was narrated step by step through the chapters of the book up to this point. Our reading tonight, as I said, is a lengthy one, but it tells its own story and makes its own point, so we'll need to add little in the way of comment when the reading is over. We'll begin at chapter 19, verse 1. "In those days Israel had no king." Here the refrain in its shorter form, but we are to, as it were, assume and to remember what it sounded like to say it in its longer form. "Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." Now, a Levite who lived in a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim took a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. The story begins, as did the first part of the epilogue, in a single Israelite home and a problem in that home. The problem, however, will lead inexorably, step by step, to civil war. We're reminded of a truth that our culture is determined to deny, namely that public good cannot be divorced from private virtue. Another striking feature of this history that you will note as we read it is that all the characters remain anonymous. The only character whose name is given is the priest, whom we will encounter in chapter 20, verse 28, and more on him later. The point seems to be, by this anonymity of each character, that the Levite is every Levite. The concubine is every Israelite woman. The Israelites as a group represent the entire nation, and so on. This episode concerns a Levite, a man charged with the spiritual leadership of the nation. His concubine was unfaithful to him. She's a concubine, not a wife, and we wonder why. What's she doing in this story? And what's she doing in this family? The previous reference to a concubine in the book of Judges in chapter 8, verse 31, leads us to expect problems. The NIV's "was unfaithful to him" literally means played the harlot or the prostitute. But she was unfaithful to him. She left him and went back to her father's house in Bethlehem, Judah. After she had been there 4 months, her husband went to her to persuade her to return. He had with him his servant and two donkeys. She took him into her father's house, and when her father saw him, he gladly welcomed him. His father-in-law, the girl's father, prevailed upon him to stay, so he remained with him 3 days, eating and drinking and sleeping there. The breach between the man and his concubine was not so complete that his effort to win her back was not greeted favorably by herself and by her father. Now, it was 4 months later Either the man had hoped she would return on her own, and he was disappointed in those hopes, or he had finally begun to miss her too much to leave matters where they were. On the fourth day, they got up early, and he prepared to leave. But the girl's father said to his son-in-law, "Refresh yourself with something to eat, then you can go." So the two of them sat down to eat and drink together. Afterward, the girl's father said, "Please stay tonight and enjoy yourself." And when the man got up to go, his father-in-law persuaded him, so he stayed there that night. On the morning of the fifth day, when he rose to go, the girl's father said, "Refresh yourself. Wait till afternoon." So the two of them ate together. Then when the man with his concubine and his servant got up to leave, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said, "Now look, it's almost evening. Spend the night here. The day's nearly over. Stay and enjoy yourself. Early tomorrow morning you can get up and be on your way home." But unwilling to stay another night, the man left and went toward Jebus, that is Jerusalem, with his two saddled donkeys and his concubine. It's not made clear in the narrative why the father-in-law proved such an importunate host, but the man's unwillingness to offend his father-in-law until finally he had lost patience explains why he and his concubine arrive in Gibeah when they do. Timing is everything. Had they left earlier in the day, the outrage at Gibeah would never have happened. When they were near Jebus and the day was almost gone, the servant said to his master, "Come, let's stop at this city of the Jebusites and spend the night." His master replied, "No, we won't go into an alien city whose people are not Israelites. We will go on to Gibeah." The Jebusites, remember, are often listed among the peoples who inhabited Canaan before the arrival of the Israelites. The irony, of course, is that the Jebusites would probably have treated these people far better than the Israelites did. The Levite and his concubine would have been better off staying with the Canaanites than proved to be the case when they stayed with the Israelites. He added, "Come, let's try to reach Gibeah or Ramah and spend the night in one of those places." So they went on, and the sun set as they neared Gibeah in Benjamin. There they stopped to spend the night. They went and sat in the city square, but no one took them into his home for the night. In good Oriental fashion, the visitors simply arrive in the city and sit down in the square, expecting to be taken in by someone. The social disintegration in Israel had reached the point that the ordinary obligations of hospitality were no longer being met. That evening, an old man from the hill country of Ephraim, who was living in Gibeah — the men of the place were Benjamites, or Benjaminites, it's spelled both ways — came in from his work in the fields. When he looked and saw the traveler in the city square, the old man asked, "Where are you going? Where did you come from?" Now, the old man is an outsider in the town as well. That may explain why he behaves better than the rest of the people. He hasn't yet been affected so completely by the moral atmosphere of the place. The Levite answered, "We are on our way from Bethlehem in Judah to a remote area in the hill country of Ephraim where I live. I have been to Bethlehem in Judah, and now I am going to the house of the Lord. No one has taken me into his house." Now we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for ourselves. Your servants, me, your maidservant, and the young man with us, we don't need anything. In other words, the moral rot has revealed itself in a loss of community, a loss so profound that even a person who would prove no burden to his host because he brought everything he needed with himself is not offered hospitality. "You are welcome at my house," the old man said. "Let me supply whatever you need, only don't spend the night in the square." So he took him into his house and fed his donkeys. After they had washed their feet, they had something to eat and drink. The old man's words suggest that he fears for them if they remain in the town square. He'd lived long enough in Gibeah to know the danger that lurks there. While they were enjoying themselves, some of the wicked men of the city surrounded the house. Pounding on the door, they shouted to the old man who owned the house, "Bring out the man who came to your house so we can have sex with him." A reader of the Bible immediately recognizes the parallel between this Levite and the men who come to Sodom the night before its destruction and stay in the house of Lot. In fact, there are numerous literary parallels, and when the two accounts are set side by side, as they often are in commentaries, you're struck by how similarly the incidences are recorded. This, of course, enhances the great moral power of the narrative. These are Israelites, not Sodomites. Or are they? The NIV's wicked men is literally men of the sons of Belial, that is to say, the devil's men. The owner of the house went outside and said to them, "No, my friends, don't be so vile. Since this man is my guest, don't do this disgraceful thing." The evil of what these men propose to do is obviously manifold. It's a violation of neighbor love and the obligations of hospitality. It is a sexual sin, and it's a sexual perversion because of it being homosexual sex. "Look, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. I will bring them out to you now, and you can use them and do to them whatever you wish." Now, if you want to underline that phrase, "whatever you wish," in verse 24, you can make a note in the margin that it's virtually the same Hebrew phrase as "do what is right in your own eyes." That is to say, the phrase that occurs in the fourfold refrain that tells us what this epilogue is all about. "But to this man, don't do such a disgraceful thing." Now, unlike Lot, and unlike the case with Lot, this man's guests can't strike the men of the town with blindness, as did the angels of the Lord who visited Lot. And so he proposes that they commit a lesser sin, the violation of these two women, one of whom was the man's own daughter. We wonder at this, but of course, that is often the case in times of moral corruption. No one sees with any kind of moral clarity anymore, and you are left supposing yourself having to choose between equally repulsive alternatives. In this case, this is male headship at its very worst. Patriarchy, as the feminist movement understands it and imagines it always to be. Men serving themselves at the expense of women. But the men would not listen to him, so the man took his concubine and sent her outside to them, and they raped her and abused her throughout the night, and at dawn they let her go. At daybreak, the woman went back to the house where her master was staying, fell down at the door, and lay there until daylight. So after doing everything this man had done to recover his concubine when she left home and went back to her father's house, the Levite now throws her to the wolves to spare himself. When her master got up in the morning and opened the door of the house and stepped out to continue on his way, there lay his concubine fallen in the doorway of the house with her hands on the threshold. He said to her, "Get up, let's go." But there was no answer. Then the man put her on his donkey and set out for home. The Levite seems genuinely heartless. After throwing his concubine to these thugs, he went to bed. He actually just went to bed. And now he expects his concubine to get up and continue the journey. But she is dead. The Benjaminites had not only raped her, they had murdered her. Or so it seems. The text is vague, and we're left wondering if she died en route home. If so, the Levite seems all the more heartless. He throws his dying wife on the donkey as if she were some sack of grain and sets out for home. When he reached home, he took a knife and cut up his concubine limb by limb into 12 parts and sent them into all the areas of Israel. Everyone who saw it said, "Such a thing has never been seen or done, not since the day the Israelites came up out of Egypt. Think about it. Consider it. Tell us what to do." The point of his gruesome act, which once again really shows no respect at all for the poor woman, was clearly to serve as a call to arms for the nation, an invitation to Israel to respond to the outrage that had been committed amongst her and within her. Now, the pace of the action slows to a crawl as the narrator describes Israel's response to what has happened in one of her towns. Then all the Israelites, from Dan to Beersheba, And from the land of Gilead came out as one man and assembled before the Lord in Mizpah. That is, all the tribes of Israel except the tribe of Benjamin. This is the first instance, by the way, of the phrase Dan to Beersheba as a description of all of Israel. That is, the country from its northernmost point to its southernmost point. Remember, we have just in the first part of the epilogue learned how it was that the tribe of Dan came to occupy the northernmost territory of the nation. And now it's going to be a common way to describe the nation from north to south. It's surprising in a way that a single Levite from Ephraim could rally the nation so successfully. Even Deborah and Barak never managed to do this. The leaders of all the people of the tribes of Israel took their places in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 soldiers armed with swords. The Benjamites heard that the Israelites had gone up to Mizpah. Then the Israelites said, "Tell us how this awful thing happened." So the Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, said, "I and my concubine came to Gibeah in Benjamin to spend the night. During the night, the men of Gibeah came after me and surrounded the house, intending to kill me. They raped my concubine, and she died." They raped my concubine. He conveniently leaves out the details that would obviously have placed his own behavior in a much less favorable light. "I took my concubine, cut her into pieces, and sent one piece to each region of Israel's inheritance because they committed this lewd and disgraceful act in Israel. Now, all of you Israelites, speak up and give your verdict." All the people rose as one man, saying, "None of us will go home. No, not one of us will return to his house. But now this is what we'll do to Gibeah. We'll go up against it as the lot directs. We'll take 10 men out of every 100 from all the tribes of Israel, and 100 from 1,000, and 1,000 from 10,000 to get provisions for the army. Then when the army arrives at Gibeah in Benjamin, it can give them what they deserve for all this vileness done in Israel." So all the men of Israel got together and united as one man against the city. The tribes of Israel sent men throughout the tribe of Benjamin, saying, "What about this awful crime that was committed among you? Now surrender those wicked men of Gibeah, so that we may put them to death and purge the evil from Israel." The effort at negotiation fails, as apparently they expected it would. But one of the demonstrations of deepening depravity in any society, and certainly in this society, was the willingness, or is the willingness, of the population at large to defend the conduct of the depraved, or at least to shield them from its rightful consequences. But the Benjamites would not listen to their fellow Israelites. From their towns, they came together at Gibeah to fight against the Israelites. At once, the Benjamites mobilized 26,000 swordsmen from their towns, in addition to 700 chosen men from those living in Gibeah. Among all these soldiers, there were 700 chosen men who were left-handed, each of whom could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. Generally, a left-handed soldier was at a disadvantage in an army of right-handed men. But if you had enough to make a contingent of left-handed warriors carrying their shields with the right, they created a new tactical problem for any army that was attacking. Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 swordsmen, all of them fighting men. The Israelites went up to Bethel and inquired of God. They said, "Who of us shall go first to fight against the Benjamites?" And the Lord replied, "Judah shall go first." Judah had gone first before. If you remember, the book opens with Judah going first. So it opens with Judah going first, and it closes with Judah going first. But then it was war against the Canaanites. We have now declined to the place that the war is against Israelites themselves. Judah may have gone first in this instance because the concubine was from Judah. The next morning, the Israelites got up and pitched camp near Gibeah. The men of Israel went out to fight the Benjamites and took up battle positions against them at Gibeah. The Benjamites came out of Gibeah and cut down 22,000 Israelites on the battlefield that day. But the men of Israel encouraged one another and again took up their positions where they had stationed themselves the first day. The Israelites went up and wept before the Lord until evening, and they inquired of the Lord. They said, "Shall we go up again to battle against the Benjamites, our brothers?" And the Lord answered, "Go up against them." Now, the narrator doesn't tell us how Benjamin had gotten the upper hand in the first battle, but it was the rout of a much larger force by a much smaller one. And nothing, of course, is said about Benjamite casualties, but they were obviously much less. In any case, we were not expecting this result. Then the Israelites drew near to Benjamin the second day. This time, when the Benjamites came out from Gibeah to oppose them, they cut down another 18,000 Israelites, all of them armed with swords. Still less were we expecting this result, a second defeat after the Lord told them to do battle. Then the Israelites, all of the people, went up to Bethel, and there they sat weeping before the Lord. They fasted that day until evening and presented burnt offerings and fellowship offerings to the Lord. And the Israelites inquired of the Lord. In those days the Ark of the Covenant of God was there with Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, ministering before it. They asked, "Shall we go up again to battle with Benjamin, our brother, or not?" And the Lord responded, "Go, for tomorrow I will give them into your hands." The prayer is apparently more heartfelt, more serious this time. They go to the sanctuary, they fast, they pray, they offer sacrifices to God. And the Lord gives them an actual promise of victory this time. Now, Phinehas, Aaron's direct descendant, was there at Bethel administering the sanctuary and his worship. And as I said, he is the only figure whose name is given to us in this history. The sense of his name seems to be that we're only a few generations removed from Moses and Aaron themselves. And see how far Israel has fallen in such a short time. Then Israel set an ambush around Gibeah. They went up against the Benjamites on the third day and took up positions against Gibeah as they had done before. One effect of the two victories so far is to lead Benjamin into overconfidence. The Benjamites came out to meet them and were drawn away from the city. They began to inflict casualties on the Israelites as before, so that about 30 men fell in the open field and on the roads, the one leading to Bethel, the other to Gibeah. While the Benjamites were saying, "We are defeating them as before," the Israelites were saying, "Let's retreat and draw them away from the city to the roads." All the men of Israel moved from their places and took up positions at Baal Tamar, and the Israelite ambush charged out of its place on the west of Gibeah. The 10,000 of Israel's finest men made a frontal attack on Gibeah. The fighting was so heavy that the Benjamites did not realize how near disaster was. The Lord defeated Benjamin before Israel, and on that day the Israelites struck down 25,100 Benjamites, all armed with swords. The victory was the Lord's. The Lord struck them down. And the two previous defeats that Benjamin inflicted on Israel made that fact all the more undeniable. 25,100 out of 26,700 fell. Then the Benjamites saw that they were beaten. Now the men of Israel had given way before Benjamin because they relied on the ambush. This is how the battle unfolded, in other words. Because they relied on the ambush they had set near Gibeah. The men who had been in ambush made a sudden dash into Gibeah, spread out, and put the whole city to the sword. The men of Israel had arranged with the ambush that they should send up a great cloud of smoke from the city, and then the men of Israel would turn in the battle. The Benjamites had begun to inflict casualties on the men of Israel, about 30, and they said, "We are defeating them as in the first battle." The battle before them was raging, of course, and so they were blind to what was happening in their rear. Israel's main body was keeping the Benjamites' main body occupied while the force in ambush entered the unprotected city and put it to the sword and set it afire. So when the Israelite army, which was facing Gibeah, saw the cloud of smoke, they stopped giving ground and the rout began. But when the column of smoke began to rise from the city, the Benjamites turned and saw the smoke of the whole city going up into the sky. Then the men of Israel turned on them, and the men of Benjamin were terrified because they realized that disaster had come upon them. So they fled before the Israelites in the direction of the desert, but they could not escape the battle, and the men of Israel who came out of the towns cut them down there. They surrounded the Benjamites, chased them, and easily overran them in the vicinity of Gibeah on the east. 18,000 Benjamites fell, all of them valiant fighters. As they turned and fled toward the desert to the Rock of Rimmon, the Israelites cut down 5,000 men along the roads. They kept pressing after the Benjamites as far as Gibeah, and struck down 2,000 more. On that day, 25,000 Benjamite swordsmen fell, all of them valiant soldiers. But they sat before the Lord until evening, raising their voices and weeping bitterly. O Lord, the God of Israel, they cried, why has this happened to Israel? Why should one tribe be missing from Israel today? They really don't know. These people are clueless. Early the next day, the people built an altar and presented burnt offerings and fellowship offerings. Then the Israelites asked, who from all the tribes of Israel has failed to assemble before the Lord? For they had taken a solemn oath that anyone who failed to assemble before the Lord at Mizpah should certainly be put to death. Someone thinks of a way of resolving this problem. The problem is that if they are to destroy the people who did not assemble with the rest of the nation, then they will not solve the problem of finding wives for the men of Benjamin who are bereft of women to marry. They'll have to fudge a bit on their oath instead, as we will see. Now the Israelites grieved for their brothers, the Benjamites. Today one tribe is cut off from Israel, they said. How can we provide wives for those who are left, since we have taken an oath by the Lord not to give them any of our daughters in marriage? Then they asked, which one of the tribes of Israel failed to assemble before the Lord at Mizpah? They discovered that no one from Jabesh-Gilead had come to the camp for the assembly. For when they counted the people, they found that none of the people of Jabesh-Gilead were there. So the assembly sent 12,000 fighting men with instructions to go to Jabesh-Gilead and put to the sword those living there, including the women and children. This is what you are to do, they said. Kill every male and every woman who is not a virgin. They found among the people living in Jabesh-Gilead 400 young women who had never slept with a man, and they took them to the camp at Shiloh in Canaan. They couldn't give their own daughters to the men of Benjamin, but nothing, they thought, prevented them from giving somebody else's daughters to them. Someone has described the entire affair as a comedy of correctness, as the elders resort to a mixture of force, casuistry, and guile to circumvent the oath sworn at Mizpah without supposedly actually breaking it. Then the whole assembly sent an offer of peace to the Benjamites at the Rock of Rimmon. So the Benjamites returned at that time and were given the women of Jabesh-Gilead who had been spared. But there were not enough for all of them. There were 600 Benjamites who had not died on the battlefield, but only 400 virgins from Jabesh-Gilead. The people grieved for Benjamin because the Lord had made a gap in the tribes of Israel. And the elders of the assembly said, with the women of Benjamin destroyed, how shall we provide wives for the men who were left? The Benjamite survivors must have heirs, they said, so that a tribe of Israel will not be wiped out. We can't give them our daughters as wives, since we Israelites have taken this oath. Cursed be anyone who gives a wife to a Benjamite. But look, there is an annual festival of the Lord in Shiloh to the north of Bethel and east of the road that goes from Bethel to Shechem and to the south of Lebonah. So they instructed the Benjamites, saying, go and hide in the vineyards and watch. When the girls of Shiloh come out to join in the dancing, then rush from the vineyards, and each of you seize a wife from the girls of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. When their fathers or brothers complain to us, we will say to them, do us a kindness by helping them, because we did not get wives for them during the war, and you are innocent since you did not give your daughters to them. In other words, they arrange for the daughters to be stolen, and then nobody can actually be guilty of having given their daughters away. Of course, any reader immediately recognizes the hypocrisy. They're giving Israel's daughters away in the crudest and the most heartless fashion, not altogether unlike what the Levite did to his concubine in Gibeah. This is supposed to be the solution to Israel's spiritual problem. The rape of one woman becomes the rape of 400 and then 200 more. Here are men figuring a way out of their problem, and as so often in history, the women bearing the brunt of the pain. The moral compass now has simply been lost altogether. Israel thinks like Canaanites think. She acts like Canaanites act. She doesn't seem to recognize the difference. She has become a nation in which violence is the solution to every problem. So this is what the Benjamites did. While the girls were dancing, each man caught one and carried her off to be his wife. Then they returned to their inheritance and rebuilt the towns and settled in them. At that time, the Israelites left that place and went home to their tribes and clans, each to his own inheritance. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. In other words, nothing that has been done in the previous chapter has the Lord's approval. These events are instead a demonstration of the moral chaos into which Israel had descended when she made her peace with the world and betrayed her covenant with the Lord. Now, just a remark or two. Interestingly, tonight we have before us a text on which the prophet Hosea preached during his ministry. Twice he makes reference to this history. First, in Hosea chapter 9, verse 9, in one of his sermons of judgment against the northern kingdom of his day, he says, "They have sunk deep into corruption as in the days of Gibeah. God will remember their wickedness and punish them for their sins." And in Hosea chapter 10, verse 9, "Since the days of Gibeah you have sinned, O Israel, and there you have remained. Did not war overtake the evildoers in Gibeah? When I please, I will punish them. Nations will be gathered against them to put them in bonds for their sin." In other words, the prophet Hosea regarded this history that we've read this evening, what happened in Gibeah and its aftermath, as an illustration of ultimate depravity. When a people forsakes the Lord, this is the kind of thing that happens and that overcomes them. This is the evil that they do. This is the judgment that befalls them, sin being visited upon them as punishment for sin. Remember, we began our studies in Judges by saying that the book sets out explicitly to describe what we call the Canaanization of Israel. Her failure to obey the Lord, to trust in his grace and power, resulted in her acceptance of coexistence with the pagans who inhabited the promised land. The Lord had warned her that if she did that, she would be corrupted and eventually ruined by that radioactive spiritual culture. And that's precisely what happened. The Canaanites were not raised by the Israelites among them. That never happens. But the Israelites were lowered by the Canaanites among them, lowered until they were spiritually, ethically, morally indistinguishable from those people who were so evil that one of the reasons Israel was given the promised land in the first place was to extinguish these people from the face of the earth. And now Israel had become just like them. And what is more, and perhaps what is worse, and what is more dangerous and more worrying, Israel had reached a point of moral and spiritual corruption that she was no longer able to diagnose her problem or find her way back to the truth. She realizes she has problems, but with an unerring instinct for the preposterous, she proposes to fix her problems by doing something that is bound to make them worse. So the problems created in the nation by a woman's rape and murder are finally resolved by wholesale kidnapping and rape. As in our own day, a culture that has become very rapidly Canaanized over the last 40 years, it's impossible to ignore the cascade of tragedy that has resulted from the sexual revolution. But the efforts to make amends for what has happened have about them always nowadays the air of the ridiculous. But no one seems to notice. No one can notice anymore. We have, as a culture, lost our ability, morally speaking, to add two and two and get four. The simplest calculations of moral life are beyond us. So the problems created by sexual license are apparently nowadays to be solved by more sexual license. The despair caused by the separation of sex from love is to be caused by a more total and complete separation of sex from love and from responsibility. The social carnage visited upon children by the instability of the home is to be solved by telling the children that it isn't their fault. Here is the true measure of Israel's spiritual nadir as the book reaches its conclusion. It's not only that she has become like the nations around her, that's obvious enough. She's like Sodom. Her behavior is just like Sodom's before its destruction. But it is worse that she can't see what has happened to her or discern a way back to God. Her sins have separated her from God so far that she cannot any longer remember what she used to be when she was in covenant with him, or what pleasure and victory there had once been in her life in walking with the Lord. In the middle of the 19th century, William Wordsworth, the great English poet, surveying what he took to be the decline of English culture in the Industrial Revolution, the encroaching tawdriness of the grasping spirit of the English middle class and upper class, the disintegration, what he thought was the once proud and noble spirit of the English people, wrote these famous lines. Milton, thou shouldest be living at this hour. England hath need of thee. She is a fen of stagnant waters, altar, sword, and pen, fireside. The heroic wealth of hall and bower have forfeited their ancient English dower of inward happiness. We are selfish men. Oh, raise us up. Return to us again and give us manners, virtue, freedom, power. Thy soul was like a star and dwelt apart. Thou hadst a voice whose sound was like the sea, pure as the naked heavens, majestic, free. So didst thou travel on life's common way in cheerful godliness, and yet thy heart the lowliest duties on herself did lay. It sounds thoughtful, even pious. And the Canaanites were actually quite an artistic and sophisticated people. One of the founders of the alphabet and written language as we know it. But that poem, of course, is nonsense. Wasn't John Milton the great poet that England needed in the 18th century? It was Christ and repentance and faith. Englishmen have been looking for Milton ever since, more and more utterly unaware that Milton couldn't help. They're like Americans who are looking for the founding fathers once again, or the return of the 50s, or any other recipe for renewal except the one that is actually needed, repentance before God and faith in Christ. Judges reminds us of the real cost of disobedience and unbelief. At last, a blindness so thick, so dark, so complete that one is oblivious to the truth that might set him free. An imprisonment so complete, so profound, so all-consuming that the prisoner has completely forgotten that he lives behind bars. Amen.